Hello world, it's me, Dennis, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Clifford Johnson. First of all, let me get my hyperbole and my fanboy overness over. Will you allow me to get through that?
You have 30 seconds.
All right, good enough. Thank you very much. I have been studying physics and physicists from a non-scientific background, from a love of the idea, but not from the equation. And yes, I can hear Feynman saying "shut up, calculate" over and over in my brain. However, I am so grateful for the opportunity to be able to chat with you and to talk with you about what you're doing and have a conversation with you, because that's what you've done in your book. That's who you are. And that's what I want to share with about you. Here's what I want to know. I'm a 71-year-old white male. Actually, will be 72 in just a few days. And I am just absolutely do not believe anything that they tell you about the press, about aging. I'm having more fun. I'm more engaged. I'm more involved than I've ever been in my entire life. So
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yes. So speaking as a
52-year-old.
There you go. I give you that as advanced publicity that there are some amazing things that are happening. So that's number one. Now, here's the second thing. I am very, very interested in origin stories. I mean, I love the idea of that moment when Watson and Crick come up with a double helix, and when Einstein suddenly is sitting in his patent second class patent chair and has the time to be able to. But what I'm also interested in is what happened before, what led up to that. And so I'm very interested in your origin story. So can you take me back to little Clifford? Where was he? When was he? What was going on in those early stages that sparked the curiosity that got it moving in the direction?
That's a really great question. And I myself am also interested in that same issue, because I'm always a little disappointed when people use the phrase that they, you know, science isn't for them, or they don't have that kind of brain or that kind of thing, because I think that's a mistake. I think that's society telling us to overly classify ourselves into, you know, you're good at language and therefore you're not good at science or what have you. I think it's all nonsense personally. And I think my evidence for that is the fact that we all pretty much start out using the rules of science to figure out how to exist in the world as children. And we're asking questions. And science is just a methodology for going through the options and figuring out answers to questions. And so Children just do that intuitively. So intuitively, in my opinion, we all start out as scientists. I think what often can make the difference, and this certainly is something that is dear to me from my own experience, what can make the difference to a lot of people in terms of how they sort of stop being scientists is because oftentimes it might be their circumstances tell them that that's not a path open to them, or that they are told immediately to start buying into that business where if maybe on that day you looked at that science thing and it didn't work out, and you weren't encouraged, or you were told, oh, well, that's not your thing because you're good at that other thing. And so I think if you don't have those things, those ways of getting off the highway, as it were, chances are you just stay on the highway, and then you find all kinds of interesting things that keep you on it because it's interesting, it's challenging, you're just figuring out the world around you. And so that's what I was doing as a kid. I was doing pretty much what every kid does, yes, which is asking questions. And given you introduce yourself as 70-something-year-old white male, yep, I should at this point also point out that, you know, I'm a black kid in a world that doesn't have many images of scientists of African descent.
And where were you globally? Where ground me?
So that is the next that's the next important thing, because so I am, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm British. I'm originally from London, but when I was very young, my parents, who are actually from the Caribbean, we all as children went back to the Caribbean with our parents moved back, and so my brother, my sister, and I went to the Caribbean, and I think that is another component of the story, another important component, because I wasn't surrounded by the usual culture around you when you're a young Black kid in the 60s and the 70s, and frankly, even now, where the culture around you is telling you, if you're going to be good at something, it's probably going to be, you know, entertainment or sport or something like that. Right.
Sure.
Not that there's anything wrong with those things. Those things are awesome. But we're not told as much that we could also be scientists and all sorts of other things that traditionally we're underrepresented in. And so the point is, I didn't have that. We didn't have TV. We didn't have all those big cultural outpourings.
Yeah.
Telling me every day, don't be interested in science because that's not your thing. Right. And so I just didn't know any better. I was just interested in asking questions. I didn't even know it was called science until later. It's just interesting stuff. What's that made of? Where did it come from? And I think people around me, I wasn't getting in trouble.
Yeah.
I wasn't bothering anyone. So no one told me stop doing that. And when I asked questions, people would answer them if they could. And then they point me to the library or something. And so I would hang out in the library and learn stuff. You know, so it was just, my point is that I think that that doesn't single me out as an unusual kid. It's unfortunate that the circumstances may have been unusual, but I think the potential is there if they want to, for many people to follow a path into science if they want to. And I think it gets harder if you're from certain backgrounds and certain circumstances.
Absolutely.
And even if you are in circumstances where, there's not a cultural issue, it's still the case that our broader sort of almost anti-intellectual culture that we live in tends to still tell people that you're either a genius or you're not, and those are apparently the only options if you're going to do science, which is ridiculous.
Yes. And this happens in your childhood. What happens when the testosterone hits hits this drug that we men have to deal with and deal with? How does that shape your vector? Does it deflect you away from the books? Does it do what? How does that work? How did that work on you, Clifford?
I was one of those kids who enjoyed his own company a lot. And I think maybe I wasn't as easily distracted by wanting to be part of the big group or what have you. I hung out with, I have my friends, what have you, but I was also very happy going, hey, this is a really interesting thing. I'm just gonna sit here and figure it out. So through my early childhood, I remember I'd always be planning a summer project, right? Which would be mostly me sitting and planning something that I would build or something like that. And then figuring out, oh, well, all kinds of stuff. I mean, later on I got into electronics. And so I was learning how to make, first of all, it starts off, it's such a cliche of a story, but fixing old radios, right?
No. It's not a cliche because there's a book called Shopcraft as Soulcraft. And that it talks about in there it talks about the value of being able to take something apart.
Yes.
And what the difference between something that is disposable, when we talk about take a cell phone and this and just throw it away and that, but when you have to take it apart and look inside and go, What, that is a capacitor? Yeah. What is a capacitor? How does it resist? What are you talking about?
Exactly. Exactly. So that would fascinate me. I would take things apart. I mean, even before electronics, it would be, you know, someone was throwing out an old watch or something. Take that apart.
And now ground us historically in time. What years are these?
Well, I was born in 68, I guess. So I would, this probably, all of this would have been happening in the mid 70s when I'm growing up.
All right. So the integrated circuit had happened, the, you know, that we were getting into. And so, all right. So that was, yeah. So that we have an understanding of where in history we're seeing that. Okay. Continue.
It's not often I get to talk to people about this in this level of detail where they know how things are different from they are now when you open things up. So that is a key point. So, yeah. So very briefly, you know, clocks and radios and stuff like that. Old mechanical clocks, what have you. People would throw stuff away as they do now. But you could go inside as a kid, find that stuff and sometimes fix it. Sometimes you didn't. Sometimes you did, right? Typically what would happen, you'd go, hey, I fixed it. No one would believe you because you're a kid, right? And now I would have it. That was how I got my first camera. Someone threw it out. I fixed it and they wouldn't believe that it was fixed. And so, okay, it's my camera, right? And so that went. So that was mostly mechanical. But then, radios and the old transistor radios were actually transistor radios in that it was mostly circuit boards with transistors, resistors and capacitors and an inductor. So you could take those things apart and see the individual components. You could figure out mostly, you know, you're looking for broken wiring or a dial doesn't work or something like that. As I got more sophisticated, as I found books that would teach me what these things meant, I would know what to then go to Radio Shack to buy with my pocket money. Which I earned by, you know, the part-time jobs and what have you. And this stayed with me through into my teen years and into my 20s, tinkering with stuff, building stuff. But yeah, in those early years, it was, I'm going to make a remote controlled, you know, flying saucer or something and scare everybody or something.
Yeah.
Let me also, maybe this was a warning that I was going to end up being a theorist and not an experimentalist, but I would design things that were always well beyond my ability to build, not because of ability so much as resources, right? I would do these incredible technical drawings of stuff where, you know, I didn't have a workshop and to construct all the components, but sometimes I would use old things, you know, old boxes, old plastic bottles, and hollow them out and make things. And, you know, they would maybe get half built and then I wouldn't have enough money to buy that missing component. Yeah. Or because it was a tiny, this is the island of Montserrat in the Caribbean, which you might want to look up if you've not heard of it.
Thank you.
Its longest dimension is 11 miles long. Right. I think it's maybe like 7 miles wide, 11 miles long. Right. So tiny, tiny island, a few thousand population. So as you can imagine, resources to build elaborate electronic projects were not easy to come by. There was one Radio Shack, which was awesome. And that was when Radio Shack actually was great. That's when they actually sold components, as opposed to now they, you know, mostly, as far as I can tell, just selling you cell phones and stuff.
Right.
But back then you could go in and you could get that particular resistor that you wanted. And there was a bin with those resistors, and there was a bin with those capacitors. And you could actually put those things into a set. You could buy a soldering iron and you could make stuff, circuit boards and stuff like that. So I used to do that a lot. And again, you know, I didn't call, that wasn't a big label over everything called science. Yeah. It was just stuff that interested me.
So, and, all right. So let me ask you a question. What were the information resources at that time? The internet has not happened.
The internet has not grounded.
So what were the information resources that would allow you to keep that this curiosity going?
I would say primarily the library in two ways. One, there'd be actually, of course, books. But what
was the library rich enough?
I mean, was it
cool?
You know, for I essentially, you know, of course it's nothing compared to what any, you know, any local library in any small town in America is probably comparable or infinitely better. But, you know, I was 8, 9, 10. How many books did I need really? Right. You need one or two really good ones. You need a couple of those sort of let's explain everything kind of books, right? It has a little bit of everything right in there. There's a little bit of biology, there's a little bit of space, there's a little bit of oceans, right? And those are endlessly engaging for a small child. As I grew up, of course, then I began to use up the library, as it were, and then begin to get frustrated and curious about the outside world. But then other sources that also would show up at the library where people would donate their old magazines. That's an awesome thing. So there are particularly, I forget, there was a, as I got more and more into electronics and particularly more and more into digital stuff, there was a magazine called Byte, B-Y-T-E.
B-Y-T-E.
I don't know if that still exists. Old issues of Byte show up at the library, and I would try and, between me and a friend of mine who was also interested in stuff, we'd try and grab those. The radio, fixing radios, you also listen to them, constantly listening to the radio. There's, you know, local stations playing music, what have you, but shortwave radio, you can get interesting stuff from far away. Yeah, so occasionally I'd hear stuff from America, you know, so I'd hear Voice of America, I'd hear the BBC, of course, I'd hear various, it turned out that one of the repeater stations for a German radio station called the Radio Antilles was actually on the island. That was an interesting station. And then I got interested in the whole idea of there's this country called Germany that this is the parent company broadcasting this stuff from and stuff like that. It was an unusual island in that there, you know, the contacts with the outside world were by today's standards very, very meager, but they were rich in the sense of the, how they kept your interest. Cruise ships that would go around the Caribbean, one of their stops would be Montserrat from time to time. And so occasionally I would meet interesting people who were on the island maybe for a day, right? The ship would dock, the little boat would come in and bring people, and they'd go around. And sometimes my siblings and I would befriend somebody from the outside world and show them around the island or what have you. And that would be a constant injection of sort of interesting people from elsewhere and a reminder that there's this wider world that that was out there. And then I think other sources, I think there were some kids in school who were from America would also bring, you know, they'd bring stuff with them, right? So if we go around to their house, like I remember there was this kid who had this enormous trunk full of Lego and we'd all go around to his house. Because, you know, he was the quote unquote rich American kid. And we'd all play with, you know, this infinite supply of Lego. And that was great. Going back to information sources, I would say also there was one other source. I actually taught myself electronics from these books I found in our house. Never told anyone. Why were they in our house? Because a long time ago, my father had done a course on electrical and electronic stuff for work. And those were the books he used. And they were just lying around in a trunk somewhere. And I found them and gobbled them up. And then I ordered more. I remember ordering from a bookstore with my saved up money from being a golf caddy. Yes. My part-time job for a while. I have no idea. I didn't know anything about golf. I just handed
right here, club. Sir. Here is right. The 7-iron for
yeah,
this.
Yeah, just right, exactly. All the clubs helpfully had a number written on them, and I'll just hand it to them. And right. So anyway, that gave me some pocket money, and I remember ordering Mastering Electronics from a bookstore, and I guess they sent away to America or wherever to get the book, and that was that. I still have that book somewhere on my shelf.
God, so that's anyway, wonderful. And did you begin to think deeper than, okay, well, these are electrons coming down below. What's below that? Did exactly. that? Yeah. How did those things begin to filter in? And what was the state of information about what? I know quantum mechanics and Born and Einstein and Bohr and all that mm-hmm. from that time. Mm-hmm. I don't even know where that got to you.
A lot of that didn't. Yeah. So the great question. I would say a lot of those issues, a lot of the issues I'm interested in now, I wasn't even aware of until later on, after I moved back to the UK, went to school there, and so on and so forth. So at that
But your
point,
basic I, curiosity, I, though, your basic, basic curiosity, saying, yeah. saying, wait a minute, there's something going yeah. on there that's deeper yeah. than.
Yeah. So of course, you know, you get every kid gets into this. What's this made of? Well, it's made of these other things. What are those made of? Well, they made of these other things, which are smaller. And so on and so forth. So those sorts of things became interesting to me. I think that was around the time when an interesting person, I think he was a doctor on the island. I think he was from Syria or somewhere like that, who my mom and I, my mom would make most of her money as a housekeeper, sometimes cleaner, and sometimes after school I would go around and help her, go around with her to the houses she would go and clean, and I would mm-hmm. help her. And so this doctor, I remember, was one of the houses we would go to.
Was this a white man?
Yeah
a white family.
And, yeah. And or I feel actually they may have been from Syria. Details don't matter. But
Syria. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Yeah, we'll talk race later, and we'll understand that.
All right. And I remember he did that usual thing that a grown up does with a kid, which is go, so what are you going to be when you grow up? Kind of thing. And I remember by that time, and this would have been. I would have been pretty young, seven, maybe something like that. And the question, so my answer was, by then I'm going to be a scientist. And then he said, what kind of scientist do you want to be? And I remember being really annoyed about that question, because no one, right? This is the early testosterone, right? I thought I was the authority among all my friends and what have you, as to, you know, what scientists and science and stuff like that. And it hadn't occurred to me that there were different kinds of scientists, and I didn't know what the answer was. And I was annoyed, kind of, also that I had to choose. So I remember going away and getting the little dictionary that we had at home, just that one dictionary. And I remember sitting down and just going page by page, trying to find every ist or ologist or what have you that I could find, and reading the definitions. And so my trajectory in life may also have been determined by whoever wrote those definitions, because when I hit physicist, it basically said something along the lines of, it's the person who studies the science that underlies all the other sciences, right? And I think I chose that partly because it meant that I would keep my options open. I could be interested in all the sciences, because if I studied the one that underlies all of them, whatever that means,
yeah,
I could keep interested. So I could keep playing with that little microscope that I had fixed that someone had thrown out, and looking at, you know, little samples of sure. pond water or what have you, or onion skin. And I could also still build radios or what sure. have you. And that would still be all physics somehow in my mind. Sure. So that was around the time when I began to get more interested in physics, and then trying to find out more about physics in the coming years. So
now this is still at the Newtonian level, right?
So this is still, you know, So I think stuff like quantum physics and stuff, I probably didn't have any idea what that was. I maybe heard the term.
Does anyone?
Good point. Yeah, and but I knew, you know, atoms, molecules, stuff like that. Of course, I began to learn stuff because then I was also that kid at school who would try and have an explanation for everything, to the point where they gave me a nickname. They gave me a nickname that I think they probably thought they were insulting me, but I secretly really loved the nickname because it was the professor. And why is that a bad thing?
Exactly.
Anyway, so yeah, I remember many times where I'd attempt to give explanations to things or explain things that I'd read in books to people, and they wouldn't always take it the right way, which was strange. Especially if they're grown-ups and don't like being told how things are by a kid, but you know, that's the world we live in. Anyway, I think I was answering something else. Yeah, so I think there was another source which is relevant to what I do now in some sense. Another source of intrigue was actually comic books. Because that was one of the other things. And again, people who grew up in that era who read comics will tell you the same story. You know, they don't have to have lived on a small island in the Caribbean. You're in a small town somewhere, and there's that one or two, you know, those little swivel stands where the comics come in, right? And you're just hoping you get there first when the new issue comes out, because there's only going to be like one or two copies of that. And that other kid, whoever they are, is going to get it before you. So same thing here. Except you'd eventually figure out, because it's such a small island, you'd figure out who had that issue and you'd trade and stuff like that. But I remember being, this is the question of what helps keep you on the path. I think it was intriguing to me that a number of the characters and a number of the storylines in comics would involve science in some way, right? There'd be a little hint of something, right? You know, a number of the most famous superheroes actually were dabbling in science, and something went wrong. Science experiment went wrong, right? The Hulk, or they were engineers or scientists who built cool stuff, right? Iron Man, stuff like that. So I remember that being interesting to me, and I think I began to be very interested in the ones that were to do with what I would, in retrospect, think of as physics and astrophysics.
Yes.
Maybe those were just the stories were told better or something. But I think that certainly those certainly were very interesting to me. You know, there's nothing beats going off on some adventure with the Fantastic Four, where they go off into some other plane of existence to look
did
for
it,
some special kind it, of energy or something.
Did it resonate with you that they did not have your skin tone? Was that an awareness to you? Did you where were you in your
That's
own
a great question.
In your own racial identity at that time?
It never occurred to me. These things while I, you know, let me take a step back. Now we talk a lot, and I talk a lot as well as an educator, about the importance of seeing yourself in something.
Yes.
Right. You know, what's the phrase people use these days? If you can see it, you can be it, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a lot of strength in that. The opposite isn't true, however, right? Which is if you don't see it, it doesn't mean you can't be it. Right. And so I think that it turns out that there was one character that I didn't know about at the time, who was also a scientist and so on and so forth. And that's actually Black Panther, you know, the made famous recently.
Sure.
By the movie from a couple of years ago. I didn't know about that until many years later. So while it would have been great if some of those characters were people of color doing awesome science things. It just didn't matter to me.
It didn't resonate. So you decided, or how did the arc go that you went to the UK for your college, and what?
Yeah. So I went back to the UK at 14, actually. And there were four more years of, you know, high school type years before then going off to college. So I arrived in a school system that was not something, not completely familiar. There was some overlap with the Caribbean, where I was in the Caribbean, because it was a British colony. We're not allowed to use that word anymore.
Colonialism, what a concept!
Yeah, it's now a British protectorate. But anyway, there you go. So there were some, you know, the rough structure of the school system was the same. The age at which you go to certain things, but the details of the curriculum not the same. So I had some catching up to do in some ways, and in other ways, I think I wasn't hampered by other things. I wasn't hampered by a lot of that cultural baggage I was telling you about. So
exactly, the conscious and unconscious biases of limitation that get put into just by being immersed in the culture. It's going to impact us in the consciousness of our beings, right?
Right, indeed. And I didn't have that. It's not that I didn't encounter racism and all of those things. It hadn't translated to me into an issue of whether I was, you know, quote unquote, smart enough to do this thing I was interested in, or what have you.
Exactly.
That just wasn't an issue.
It's just a different
racism, which is all around you, whether you're whatever part of the world you're in, it just manifested itself differently.
Sure.
But then I came to the UK, and it was a whole other thing, because then, you know. Yeah. It was almost perfect timing, in the sense that I had just gotten to the age, you know, I was 14. I'd just gotten to the age.
And what
where
year is this?
This is whatever 68 plus 14 is.
82. All right, so this is pre-internet. This is when these are the 80s. This is the Reagan Thatcher years.
Coming up that way,
coming up that way.
I guess it would have been, because the Falklands had happened. Right.
So this is still when Britain was going through this great contraction of conservatism and all that. All right, and that I just wanted to historically set the landscape. What was going on? Go ahead.
Great. And so then you have, from my perspective, I was hungry, in the sense that I had pretty much used up the library on the island by then. And I was very interested in this bigger outside world that I didn't have access to.
What a wonderful place to be hungry.
Yeah. So then I arrive. Okay. With awesome school system, with an awesome library, with awesome everything. So I remember going with my mom to the school that we had been assigned to based on our neighborhood. And they asked me what subjects. Well,
now this is public or private school, depending upon what
public school. Yeah.
So this is public school, which is our in the U.S. private school.
No. I was already translating for you.
You're a freelancer. All right. So it was there. Yeah. All right.
Public
school. Yes.
Go ahead. In 1982, with a black family from the Caribbean landing in the north of England with maybe $50 to rub together, I'm not going to be going to a fancy private school, right?
Okay. Okay, so this was yes.
So good. So, no, this was just a regular school, the regular neighborhood school based on what you lived in. And at the time you show up and there's a curriculum of different subjects and a timetable, and they go, you know, what subjects do you want to do? And I just ticked every box I possibly could. It was the kid in the candy store moment. And I just remember that. So of course then physics, biology, chemistry, mathematics, art, technical drawing, literature, all of these things that I wanted more
of. Yes.
They were all there and I just ticked them all. And then I spent unfortunately, I think I spent maybe the first several months then battling the low expectations of the teachers in the school, right? I ticked all these boxes and they probably rolled their eyes and thought, who does this kid think he is? I began to then, I would say for the next several years, I began to learn to see the signs of people, sort of teachers especially, keeping track, interested in what's going to turn out with me. And then I clearly was a subject of a lot of conversations, some positive, some negative. And I could tell that because I remember I would go on school trips and I would arrive at, you know, we'd all be introduced to the, you know, the host or the teacher. And they always seemed to know about me before I'd opened my mouth, right? So clearly, yeah. So I remember beginning to learn that. But going tracking back a bit, I definitely then was trying to fight against expectations. They in a number of cases, they would have two streams in a classroom. Did they use that term here?
But yes. It'd be the, oh, know, absolutely.
The quote-unquote gifted kids and the regular kids, the A class and the B class. And I would almost always be put in the B class.
Really? But, that's so fascinating that a man of your mind and a child of your mind and a child of that, and my heart goes out to you, number one, but this is fascinating in a horrible way,
mm-hmm.
how we would do that, and how many other children?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, for God's sake!
Yeah. So I think I was lucky, and I to their credit, I think a number of teachers weren't doing that by default.
And they clicked.
And they clicked, or they rapidly saw that they'd made a mistake, and switched me. If it were timetablingly possible, it wasn't always. And I always think about all those other kids who were just like me, for which that didn't happen.
Exactly.
What potential was not unlocked.
Oh, but for the grace of the verse.
Yeah. And so that, you know, for me is one of the most important guiding principles in how I face the world, which is I think everyone has a huge amount of potential and we should try and help unlock that potential. We should make assumptions.
I mean, isn't it the difference between setting something, setting a piece of coal on fire or unlocking the energy that is within that piece of coal?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, but it turned out okay because I was able to do all those different subjects in one shape or form and rapidly found... partly because they were challenging at first because I was coming from a different system. I think that actually helped inspire me.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it were maybe just too easy to take in my stride initially, I may have become complacent and got distracted. So yeah. I remember the mathematics class started. I arrived there the first time I'm in that school. Mathematics class, you know, it may not be the first, it would have been the first week.
Yes.
And there was a test. I think the idea was that they were, you know, trying to see where everyone was.
Sure.
It was kind of, we've done all this stuff the last however many years, now we're going to put it all together and here's this test. And I did so badly. on that test. Because I'd never done any of those things. I didn't know what any of the terms meant. We'd never done any of those things. We'd done some kind of mathematics. It's a very good school system in the Caribbean as well, but we didn't do those operations on those things. So I just didn't know what I was doing. I think I maybe got like 20% or something like that. So that could have set me on a path direction, but I remember going, this is never going to happen again. And by the end of that fall, the way that teacher ran that class was basically there was a group of students who were pretty self-motivated. You just got the textbook and you just worked through it at your own speed. And so I got a copy of the textbook and I just worked through it. And by the end of that first semester, coming up for the winter holidays, so usually you do that. That's a 2-year thing. It's what are called mm-hmm. O-levels in those days. It's a 2-year thing. And at the end of 2 years, you take the final exam, you get a certificate, your graduate certificate saying you get a grade, what have you. Right. By halfway through that first year, we'd all essentially finished the book. A group of us had just finished the book. And I was part of that group because I caught up. And so we took that a year early. We took the final exam for that a year early. So that was the trajectory going from showing up and not knowing what any of that stuff is to going through that stuff. And I still don't think I am exceptionally talented in any way. I think it's a mixture of, you know, enthusiasm, hard work, and believing that this is something you want to do and can do.
But I have looked at every single creative genius I've ever seen, and it's always been those three elements. Yeah. This is what it comes from. Yeah. It comes out of that. This isn't just some gifted, bestowed piece of work. It doesn't work that way.
It's hard work. Mostly hard work. Yeah.
And so did you find an appreciation for mathematics? Were you beginning to go, wait a minute, there's something elegant here. There's something I'm understanding that, wait a minute, there's something even deeper in this part of it.
Patterns. It's all about spotting patterns. And in some sense, if you want to say what mathematics is as a subject, it's in some ways, it's the science of patterns in some broad sense. And that has always been fascinating to me because jumping back years, going back to the Caribbean, I wasn't only just fixing radios and reading comics and what have you. I was also doing needlework with my mom. And one of my favorite things is crochet. I don't know if you know what that is.
Do. Of course, these are all patterns and rhythms and being able to work it through. And there's such a not. Oh God, this is.
Yeah. So crochet primarily, some knitting, also macrame, which is another one. All of those things I found fascinating, not because I thought, oh, these are secretly all to do with science. I just thought it was interesting. Oh, you're right. You do this stitch 5 times, and then you do this one, then you turn, you go back, and then eventually you build this whole pattern, right? Or we do those French doilies a lot, which you can use as placemats or what have you. I loved making
armrests,
And so I think my brain from that, from needlework of all things, my brain was ready to see more patterns, to start seeing interlocking patterns.
Oh my God. Yeah. And so when did the fire of physics, I mean, we talk about the physics of physical physics, but then wait a minute, there is, there's something here that I want to go that way.
Yeah. So I would say, certainly through those high school years, I would then, because I had more sources, I had now the awesome library. This is in the north of England, a town called Preston.
Preston.
In Lancashire. For a cultural reference, It's 20 something miles away from Liverpool, where the Beatles are from, right?
Exactly. So good, exactly. Good. But it's so not, and it's working class, or it's
Exactly. Yeah, okay. So it's an old mill town. A lot of those red brick long buildings with no windows, with good. With the tall chimney. It's
perfect. It's,
that whole area is where the whole industrial revolution kicked off, and all of that stuff. Yeah. Lots of rivers with old mills next to them where it's of course I didn't know that at the time. I learned that at school. I learned that at school there. The library there, however, was amazing. It's still a fantastic library, the town library, and I would go there a lot and discovered a lot there, just spend a lot of time reading and borrowing books. And so then I was able to explore more about the wider world of science that interested me, the wider world of mathematics that interested me. I was also hugely a reader of things, you know, science fiction and things like that. So, you know, you could just get lots of stuff. So I was thinking between science fact and science fiction, I was certainly getting a lot of a taste of those sorts of questions that I wanted to explore about the world at some other level besides just what we see. So particle physics and things like that began to interest me. Certainly by the time I got to the next 2 years, 17, 18, before you go off to college, university, I was at a different school then called Newman College. And that was when I started reading about things we would call particle physics today, you know, what's happening inside the nucleus and things. And a lot of that was coming from popular books by at the time. Trying to think what authors would be. Gosh, at that time, this would have been still a little bit before, you know, Brief History of Time and stuff like that. But that did come later. I did read that. But there were other people besides Hawking would write books like that, and I would read
them. And before Brian Greene and before all that. That was before we were talking about that. And what was the state of particle physics at that time? Because we hadn't had the Hadron, and we haven't done that, and we certainly hadn't gotten into string theory to know what that was about. But what was the mindset of the physicists and the theorists?
Yeah.
Because you're a theorist, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so what was the general sense of that? Feynman was, of course, around with the Feynman diagrams and all of my hero. But what was the sense of that? And
right, well, of course, I can tell you now a lot about that because now I know because I'm one of those theorists doing that sort of stuff. at the time, of course, I didn't have a particularly good view of what the greats were up to in the mid 80s. But I can certainly tell you now. Of great interest was trying to understand the strong interactions, really sort that out, the strong nuclear interactions. So there was a lot going from the late 60s into the 70s, refinements as to what that what the theory of the nuclear interactions should look like in its final form. Were still being sorted out. We'd understood very famously because of, most famously Feynman, but others like Schwinger and Tominaga and Dyson and people like that had sorted out the interaction involving electromagnetism.
Yeah.
Quantum electrodynamics was the crowning glory of fundamental interaction theory,
right?
And that's what Feynman diagrams, for example, were discovered to help calculate with that, and so on and so forth. And so the thought was that should work also for other kinds of interactions, in nuclear physics, with what was eventually sorted out to be the strong force
and
the weak force.
Is that right? I love knowing a word without really understanding anything underneath it, other than just knowing the word. But thank you for taking me along the journey.
Oh, no, that's fine. And so people were trying to write down, or people had written down analogs of quantum electrodynamics for those. And so one of the issues was to use it to calculate. It's much harder to calculate with those theories than they were for electrodynamics. Mm-hmm. For reasons that would take me a little further afield than is perhaps necessary to explain, but it's essentially in some ways the strong force exactly in some especially is a lot stronger, and it's harder to just describe in terms of nice, well-defined individual particles that occasionally interact by exchanging a particle. So it wasn't clear for some time that that was the right thing to do. But it emerged in the late 70s into the 80s that that was the right thing. And then things like QCD, quantum chromodynamics, really, really began to take center stage. And so the whole formalism called quantum field theory for describing nature really was cemented in those decades.
Yeah, go ahead. Continue.
But then, because this is very relevant to what I ended up doing, then the question was: there's one very important interaction, which is gravity. can that by just one left other than the other three?
Yeah, we were going to ignore that for a long time. We'll just leave that one out and then come back to it later.
Right, and when you try and describe it with quantum field theory. Spectacularly, it doesn't work. And so one of the big questions is, how do you describe gravity, which Einstein taught us is to do with the dynamics of space and time? How do you describe that at a quantum mechanical level if the main tool we have isn't working? And so that was around the time, what the big excitement that was coming up. People had already been playing with early versions of what was to be called string theory. But it was in the early 80s that a real breakthrough was made by Mike Green and John Schwartz that showed that certain technical consistency problems could be solved. And it really got people very excited about string theory at around the mid 80s.
Yes.
And not long after that began to make it into, as you know, you'd have your popular level book about physics talking about, you know, quarks and what have you. And then maybe a last chapter where they'd go, and maybe this thing called string theory is going to help fix it. And then it would end because, you know, that was all there was. But then going to college and through college years then, so 86 to 89, that began to really interest me, so that by the time I was ready to apply to grad school, I wanted to go to grad school to do to work on things to do with string theory and quantum gravity and stuff like that.
Yeah. And you went and did you find professors who then recognized your your hunger, your and nurtured you, and others that didn't know? What was the this
same? Some did, some didn't. I remember. So I was part of what was and probably still remains the largest undergraduate physics program on the planet. That was Imperial College. I was there at Imperial College, a part of the London University. The class size is 200. 200 kids coming in who have declared that they're doing physics. They enter. So a different system from here where you can. You just go to college and you don't have to declare your major.
No.
Right. Yeah, right. So there you apply to do the subject you're going to do and you do it in 3 years and you're done. That's how that works. And so I applied to do physics to a bunch of places and Imperial was one of the places that said yes. And I went because London and Imperial had all of this amazing science history, right? And it sounded like this amazing place to be, and it was in London. That was when I was also culturally getting turned on, and by culturally, I mean just interested in the broader culture of the arts as well as the sciences. Mm-hmm. And so London, of course, is a hub for all the stuff I was getting interested in music art and stuff like that. Yes. And so it was an amazing time for me to go to London as well. So anyway, I went there. And so cutting to the chase, there are 200 of us in a lecture theater getting our physics lectures. It was an amazing time. So you within that you could find your group, as it were. And so I had my friends and what have you, and we did okay. We weren't the overly keen ones sitting in the front row, and we weren't the troublemakers sitting all the way in the back row. We were somewhere, you know, in the middle, slightly mm-hmm. the front, kind of.
Sure.
And we did just fine. And I did pretty well. I ended up, you know, graduating with honors at they classify your bachelor's degree. So I, in the UK, I did graduate with a first class degree with honors and all that. It was a combination of encouraging professors sort of, you know, doing their job, and some who I think took an extra interest because maybe I was unusual for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And some who probably had some low expectations as well. I remember when I was applying to graduate school, Imperial was actually one of the top places doing string theory and all those sorts of things. And so I applied there. And I remember being taken, being sat down in the office of the person who handles, who was the head of the group, who told me, and you know, this is almost a verbatim quote, that they were not going to admit me to their program because there were one or two other applicants from Imperial who were smarter. He actually used that word. They were going with someone smarter, and so encouraging. And I went off.
How did you handle that emotionally? How did you deal with the 10 minutes after that as you're walking out and to get your emotional resilience to be able to deal with something like that? What was your process, Clifford?
So I'm not going to claim I remember it in great detail. I do remember being extremely upset. Very rapidly coming out of that with the resolve that, something along the lines of, well, you know, I'll show them kind of thing. And it turned out that, it's the old adage, which I didn't know at the time, you know, doing well is the best revenge kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
What I didn't realize, jumping forward by 5 years, I want to say. I didn't realize I would have the opportunity to talk to that same guy on the phone many years later, when he was making me an offer to come as a postdoctoral researcher to his group, and me turning him down. And I wish to this day that, as an echo of his, we're going with someone smarter, I wish to this day that I had said, I'm going somewhere better, which was the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. But I don't think I did get to say that. I think it was one of those things where you put the phone down and go, oh, man.
I knew I wanted to say.
Exactly. I want to do over. But yes, I did get to say to that same person many years later. For all I know, he didn't even remember who, you know, but it didn't matter.
It doesn't. All right, Clifford, let me say this. I deliberately took you on this longer path, hoping that it would entice you that in the very near future, you will do a program that picks up from here, that you will have found enough interest in what we were talking about, because I want to know the next chapters. Okay. And I want to know how not only how you grew, but the places of how you grew along with physics and where we are, because I have so many questions about that. And if you will give me another opportunity, We will continue down this story.
And that continue. That sounds like a good plan. It's kind of interesting, and it's been a while since I thought about some of these little bits of personal history. So it's fun to dust them off. And
I'm so glad, because this is human beings talking to human beings about the human experience, and I don't think that you can take the human out of the scientist. And
indeed,
still, and you know shouldn't. Who that person is. Or what we are, or how we got there. So I thank you for that time. I thank you for the opportunity to learn more. And I have so many questions. So we will talk again, there will be links on your book, and there will be links to your TED Talks that will give people ideas to be able to go if they don't come back to that second one. But we're going to talk all about art and all about the work we do. And have a lovely day.
Thank you. Same to you. And thanks for this opportunity. It was a lot of fun.
I will thank Renee for that. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.